I have some very tentative and groping formulations for something about which I feel very strongly and about something which I think I grasp intuitively. And I think I have enough here for about 20 lectures. So you'll have to stop me, I think, today so we have some time for discussion. The issue of our time, the primary issue of our time is religious. The issue is not technology, it's not politics, it's not economics, it's not a social issue, it's not a cultural issue, it isn't even a matter of integrity in politics. Very subordinate issue. The issue is religious. The issue is not freedom or equality, as ordinarily understood. All the freedom movements, all the liberation movements, important though they be, are not what's at stake. This is to say that the issue of our time, as I see it, is the substance or the content of the best and the brightest. Another way of putting it would be to say that the more the best and the brightest rule, the worse things will get. The more the best and the brightest rule, or the more the best and the brightest are in leadership positions, the less we will deal with the real issue of our time. That is, with the question of the meaning of human existence. We will never deal with energy, or drugs, or crime, or race, or anything else, I think. We'll never deal with these issues, and we're not dealing with these issues as long as we do not deal with the meaning of America. I've been dealing with the energy crisis for the last 6 months, trying to think about it, and I'm convinced we'll not deal with the energy crisis except we deal with ourselves. What is at issue then? Is the image of success, our image of success, our image of fulfillment, our goals and purposes. That's why I say if the best and the brightest rule, it will make the problem for us in some ways less difficult, because they will make more of a problem, but in other ways more difficult. The question then is, what do we want to be? What do we want our kids to be? And I don't think it helps much to say that we want our kids to be free to be themselves. What is at issue is, what is the self? I think this is a cop-out to say we want them to be free to be themselves, kind of the masthead of permissive education. What is at issue is what we think it would be to be ourselves. What is at issue is what our real self is. Let me hesitate for a moment to quote from a paper I've written for a group in Chicago, sponsored by the Church Federation, for a conference on the global issues of our time. Serious persons of great integrity, with vast experience and extensive knowledge, with deep loyalties to the traditions of the Christian West and to the religious and social institutions embodying those traditions, differ in their interpretations of the situation today. You must understand, I understand myself only by giving one interpretation. There are many other interpretations. Some of my colleagues, with as much education and experience as I have, would not agree with me in my interpretation. They would not see the issue the way I do. So here is one interpretation. Now, the basis for my interpretation, I might say a few words, would what experience I've had out of which this grows. I spent 17 years in one parish, not as a minister, but doing everything else but being a minister, trying to experiment, to explore, to be present, to do whatever that parish asked me to do. Spent 12 years with the Church Federation of Chicago trying to figure out how to help the city become human. Spent some time with the Baptist Convention, American Baptist Convention, trying to think through the theological issues of our time. Some time with the National Council. I spent 7.5 years with the Freedom Movement in Chicago. Very concrete work. Among other things, I was a business agent for 40 black contractors and had $25 million worth of contracts to hand out. 23 years at the University of Chicago Divinity School studying theology, ethics, and the social sciences. I've spent a great deal of time recently trying to understand what the issue is according to various interpretations. Are we in a post-Christian West? What are we in? And perhaps one of the most significant things in my experience has been 4 years of holding. Because it's always a great culture shock after being here from 4 to 7 or 8 weeks to go back into the world, not that one escapes the world. So I've slowly come to these judgments. I want to divide my topics into 4 parts, and under each part I'm going to deal with 3 questions. What we are, what we think we are, and what we might be. There are 4 issues then. Today I want to talk about the dimension of necessity, what Hannah Arendt calls labor. Tomorrow, the dimension of creativity, what Hannah Arendt calls work. Friday, the dimension of order, what Hannah Arendt might call politics. And Saturday, the dimension of the sacred, the religious. Let me summarize what I'm going to say in these 4 days. Some of you may never get back, or I may never get a chance to say it to you again. In the realm of necessity or labor, then, I think the fact is that we live under the tyranny of necessity. In other words, necessity, the realm of necessity, what we do in order to survive dominates our existence. I think the myth about this is that we choose what we want. That is, what we think we're doing, or what we think we are, is choosing what we want. That is, we think we are choosing what we consider to be a necessity. And I think the possibility for something else is to understand this and slowly to become free from the tyranny of necessity. And I'd like to put it in a phrase, kind of catchy, but I think it sums up much of what would help us become free. We are born to retire. And I think if we could really take that seriously, we might be able to subordinate the whole realm of necessity to something else. The second area will be the area of work or creativity. I think we exist under a tyranny of creativity. There's several things that enter into this creativity. It's a tyranny of the future. It's a tyranny of seeing the present as the means to the future. It's a lack of meaning in the present. And it's seeing the future kind of as a product. Now the myth, I think, that we really believe is that the new is better than the old. I think we believe that it's better to shape and to make than to receive. I think we believe that technology is neutral and that science is objective. The possibility then is to have a kind of dialectic of time in which the past, present, and future each are conceived of as important, but no one dominates. And those of you who saw Peebs, the movie that was here, will recall that part of the family was trying to deal with a grandmother who was unable to respond to much in terms of the future. And only when one of the grandsons began to deal with her in terms of the past did she become alive, and was there any meaning in the relationship. Well, they were talking about where they were going to school next year and all of these things in the future to her, which didn't get any response. It's only a thought. The third subject, I will call the order, the issue of order. And I think the fact is we live in an order of interdependence. We live in an order of other initiation or control of us. We live in a world in which we and us are much more realities than we will admit. And the myth or the ideology, take Jacques Ellul, the political illusion, for example, is that we really are able to choose, that we're independent centers of power with choice. And I think we might move out of this in several directions. One would be in terms of the formation of a public, in which individuals would participate in the formation of a consensus under some kind of leadership, perhaps leadership of the wiser. The essence of this matter of order, I think, can be understood. We live really in the Protestant era, in the era in which the Protestant principle is dominating, and that means in which we think somehow by initiating on our own, without any thought of an informing substance, what my mentor Paul Tillich would call a Catholic substance, that we can survive. In another way, it might be said that we have eliminated the law. The law conceived of, in some sense, is holding up the direction of our existence. In our effort, particularly in our thinking or in our pronouncements, to be free from the condemnation of the law does not necessarily free us from the embodiment of the law. We don't have a law for our time. I guess all I'm saying today is we don't have any law for our time. The law for our time, which we consider to be the law, is what is the problem. It's the content of the law that's the problem. It's that which makes us feel guilty, which is the problem. We shouldn't feel guilty about a lot of things we do. Not because we aren't guilty of some things, but because they're the wrong things to feel guilty about. You might say, if you're say, using a psychological analysis, when you become neurotic or psychotic, you're afraid of the things about which you shouldn't be afraid of, or there's no reason to be afraid of. I think we're guilty because we're not successful in the images of success, which I think are very, very problematic. The fourth area is the area of faith, the sacred. And I think here the reality is that we've identified Christianity with a tyranny of necessity, with a tyranny of self-creativity, and with a tyranny of self-initiation. I think we really believe there's a separation of church and state, that there's really a separation of the sacred and profane. And I think, in fact, there isn't. But we live under the myth. And living under the myth, we read into our faith all of the cultural images which I think are idolatrous. At least they're very ambiguous. This is a way of getting out of having to defend an absolutist statement, certainly. And it seems to me that the possibility here is that there's a unity of the sacred and the profane. I put another word, in other words, there's a dialectics of eschatological and historical perspectives in which the historical or the profane is shot through and through with transcendent meaning. And that means that it is eschatological and historical at the same time. Well, so much for what I'm going to do over these 4 days, I hope. Now, first, then, the realm of necessity or of labor, the tyranny of necessity. And under this topic, I want to deal with the tyranny of necessity, the necessities, the tyranny of technology, the tyranny of science, the tyranny of the technocrat, and the tyranny of education for a job. First, then, what is the reality that is functioning? And here I follow Herbert Marcuse. And I've been very impressed by his interpretation of what is happening to us. The analysis goes somewhat like this in brief, that you can't deal with the psyche of a person without understanding that all of our psyches are a combination of something down underneath that's real and something that is the result of socialization. And so when we try to deal with what we are and what our needs are, we have a very difficult time, and we tend to get mixed up what is the result of socialization and what can be said to be, in some sense, an essential self. So Marcuse has then four different elements: the psyche that is real, really desired and self-shaped, the psyche as privacy, he says, that is otherwise unreal, not really desired, and which societal forces define the psyche. They have public power and societal forces. Now, what Marcuse is saying is that we are the products of a societal force which creates wants. These are not real wants. Much of what we do is the result of having been conditioned to want something which the society needs us to want in order to survive. In that sense, the psyche is a political problem. That is, it's created by the politics, using politics now in the broad sense of the social and political. That is to say, what you think you want is in no sense what you really want, because it is what the society wants you to want, creates you to want, in order to keep itself going. Now, if there's a problem in the society in terms of its values and what it wants and what it is conditioning you to want, then you have a problem if those values are not your values. Now, let me try to explain in greater detail how Marcuse gets that. He really uses a Freudian analysis and says that we have been conditioned in the West to subordinate enjoyment, to subordinate our experiences of joy in order to survive. That means that in order to provide for our living, we have to give up what we would like to do. That is, simply in order to survive, as Freud said, in order to have civilization with some order and in order to survive, you had to give up what you wanted to do. So we have been conditioned, and all the images are, in terms of time, that we live for the future. You discipline yourself. You give up what you might like to do in education and everything else. You continually prepare for something. We discipline ourselves, and we hold up these images of success, which are persons giving up their what might be real for them at that moment, at least, the present for the future. I know my mother really insisted. She didn't like me to enjoy life or to go out for football or anything. She really thought I ought to be studying all the time. And if I weren't working, studying, I ought to be working. I ought to be doing something that was, very important for creating what evidently in her mind was some great role I was going to play in society. Very ambiguous. But Marcuse says that both for the sake of necessity and for the sake of control, our psyches, our persons, our personalities, our beings, our fashion, and the values are held up before us so that we serve the realm of necessity. Now, there's a certain amount of that that's necessary. But what Marcuse says is that in our society, we have long passed the stage where what we do in order to survive is necessary for survival. So we have a society which creates all kinds of images of status, all kinds of images of success, which causes us to want all the things we want, to have all the materials we have, to have all the possessions we have, to do many of the things we do. And I am inclined to agree with him. That is, I buy into that. I don't know what in me wants it to be that way. Well, you're always suspicious now. When you get enough learning, you're suspicious of why you think anyway, about anything. You think there's some hidden cause for your thinking. It couldn't be true. I mean, it couldn't simply be a fact. You must have some hidden desire that makes you see truth that way. Now, as over against what Marcuse is saying, we think that we choose what we want. And the image in our society, the imagined reality is that we choose to work hard to give up the present for the future, that we really choose that's something that's a part of our being, and it's self-actualization is involved. We really want all the gadgets we have. Now, I think there's no way to begin any reversal of the, just take energy use. And the amount of energy we use and the problems now with supplying of that energy, I think there's no way to get any reversal there. You know what happens on the highways and everywhere else. We're not really saving energy until we begin to think about what we might want to be, and we put the world of survival underneath some other view of what is important. Everything depends upon this world of survival, of what I call the tyranny of necessity. We spend most of our lives getting the things we think we need in order to survive, or producing the things that other people think they need in order to survive. Now, if we don't need those things to survive, it really is very meaningless to produce them for somebody else. It's meaningless to produce it, to work so hard to produce them for ourselves. And if other people don't really need them, if they really are as meaningless as Marcuse says, then there's very little meaning in most of our jobs. How can you really produce, as I say, a big Chrysler car today? What meaning is there in it when all of your thoughts about energy suggest that big Chrysler car is somehow counterproductive? It's dysfunctional. Now, many of the things we do aren't as obviously dysfunctional as a car that only gets 10 miles per gallon. But according to Marcuse, and I agree with him, there are many things that are equally dysfunctional from the point of view of meaning. So what we need then is a redefinition of survival, a redefinition of wants, a freedom from the tyranny of necessity. And the only freedom I know of here is to recognize what is happening to us. And Marcuse says this is very difficult. He says these wants are almost biological. They're so deep within us. We think we really want these things, but we have been created by the whole socialization process to want these. Now, this is a very practical matter for a person, for a family, to decide how they can reduce the realm of necessity so that they will have the time to think about something else and to begin to build a different lifestyle. I'm not saying that one might not find meaning in the kind of job that some people have. I was just reading recently about six men from $40,000 to $75,000 a year men who were out of work and what had happened to their families. And one guy wouldn't even tell his kids that he was out of work. He said, I'm not going to give them the image of failure. And several of them didn't want their names to be known. And one fellow said, well, I keep up appearances. I just bought 3 new suits. It's a strange world we live in, I think. But it's understandable, because we all live in it. We all participate in it. So if you go down the list of things that we do, housing, food, clothes, furniture, gadgets, TV, stereos, mowers, cars, records, tapes, alcohol, education for our kids, one of the biggest things to get over, you know, at nice colleges, nice Lutheran colleges that cost $3,000 a year. Books, boats, eating out, travel, entertainment, airplanes, campers, art, all this stuff. You mean it's more?
Give your money 5 to 1 in your economy and 10 to 1 in your economy.
Yeah.
Going against the real
Now, how you deal with that, of course, is another matter. And I've got some theories about how to begin to deal with the problem of education. But it comes, if education, and that's my fifth point, of course, if education is education for a job, and the jobs are having a spot in this kind of an economy is as ambiguous as I think it is, then we're not quite sure what we're sending them to school for, I think. I think it's a very, very mixed up, complicated matter. Well, let me talk just a little about the tyranny of technology. I think what we are here is that we do what we can do. And we want things at our disposal. Technology, I think, is a way of being in which things are at our disposal. It's instrumental, but it's something more. Now, what we think technology is that it's merely a means. We think it's neutral. We think that nature is simply available to us to command, and that we have a kind of infinite capacity to transform nature. Now, over against that, the position I'm taking, I'm following Martin Heidegger here, is that nature is a part of creation. And as a part of creation, it's subject to Christ, and hence it has a call upon us. And it no longer stands over against us as simply something we can use, but it stands on its own in a context of mutuality as a co-being. So that nature is a realm of grace. And as I see it, limitations that nature is now placing upon us have to be looked at as the operation of grace. This is really, I don't think it's idolatrous to say, that God is speaking to us through nature and saying, wait a minute. What's the meaning of all that you're doing? What does this amount to? What have you sold yourself for? And I'm not trying to say the technology is negative here, completely negative, only destructive. I think Tom Grossing interpreted some of the things I said when I was talking about this last time. It's saying that the technology is simply destructive. That isn't true. Technology is a way of being. It's a way of commandeering. And insofar as we have to commandeer, then we're going to be involved in it. But it isn't a neutral thing. I mean, it isn't just something that you can let develop, and it's kind of outside the realm of meaning. It is a way of being, I think. It's a way of conscripting nature. It's a way of steering. It's a way of controlling. And insofar as that way is a necessary part, it's just like the realm of necessity. Insofar as you've got to do something in order to survive, you've got to do it. But insofar as that is only for the sake of survival and you recognize it, then it goes way down under in terms of the time you spend on it and the meaning of it. It becomes the base, the ground, and the same with technology. It becomes a base or a ground. And you recognize the ambiguity of it, and you just don't turn your life over to the realm of necessity or to the realm of technology. And the same is true with science. And here I follow Rotsak. Not that I think Rotsak has brought us out of the dark at all, but he certainly revealed a little bit of the dark we're in. In terms of the domination of science. I wouldn't want to be misunderstood again and simply be said to be saying that science is all negative. Where the wasteland ends. Rotsak says the wasteland is a culture created by technocrats who use science to create an artificial environment of merchandise. The scientific mode of thinking reduces the consciousness to what can be measured. The need for the so-called objective knowledge of science to understand the artificial environment makes it impossible for the ordinary citizen to participate in decisions. The result is a repression of religious sensibilities, of imagination, of visionary powers, of the sacred, of nature, of spiritual being, of dialogue, of politics. He takes it all in. What becomes important for us then is what people make in the development of control over everything and especially over the natural. Nature becomes simply an instrument for making rather than that of which we are an intimate organic part. In spite of the fact that it has mothered us, we look upon ourselves as independent of it. Furthermore, we have flattened out and denuded nature and life until it loses its mystery and its depth, both inside us and outside us. But the knight was saying in the movie that he wanted to get God, you know, where he could feel him, where he could see him, sense him. And he had trouble, although he seems to have come a little bit to himself in the end in terms of this. It's really Berkeley's struggle, I think, personally, to try to measure God, to measure all of reality, to be able to catch it in some sort of device. The products and projects of technology are what are real. Man's perceptions and experiences before the development of modern science are unreal, in many respects illusions. Talks about the urban sprawl, the fact we're sealed off from the world outside of what we have made by our urban culture, and we are sealed off from ourselves by our industrial projects, in which we become, to quote him, but a small knot of neural complexity not yet simulable by electronic means, obediently serving the great technological project at hand by integrating itself totally with the apparatus surrounding it. Boy, that's the thing. Whitehead says that the things that are always present, the things that are characteristic of everything, the reality that supports and sustains every human being and every other being, is not observable in the way we observe things because it's always present. And we observe only what moves. So that the mysterious underlying support for our being, that which is nearer than hands and feet, is not something that can be caught in the net of the devices by virtue of which we look at reality. Just read another short passage. What Rotzek says is the answer then. What is required to counteract this wasteland is what Rotzek calls revolutionary mysticism. Mystical in that it expands our persons and their sensory apparatus to include all of our being, including our mind, and expands our world to include the layers of reality covered over or ignored by the scientific worldview, and views a person as deeply enmeshed in this rich, many-layered, or multidimensional world. Goes on to talk about pearls and the whole movement toward body, and sees the problem in that, which many of us have become involved in one way or another, as really missing the depth, what he called metaphysical depth, what we would call religious reality, God, it still is trying to deal with a deeper, richer, fuller view of reality, but misses some of the layers, some of the dimensions. Well, part and parcel of this being tied to necessity means that our politicians really become those who can deal with this world of necessity, what we call technocrats. And I said at the beginning that the best and the brightest create the problem, and in a sense I follow David Halberstam here, who in the best and the brightest shows what a fellow like McNamara, who had all the technical knowledge that our society and our modern world can provide in terms of knowing how to put things on computers and figure out interrelatedness of reality in terms of what science can produce, and still made, I think, personally, I follow Halberstam and what little I know about it, one of the most wrong decisions, inhuman decisions that this country has ever made. Participated in it, supported it, wouldn't let anything get in the way of it. And he was only one of a number who participated. This is not a matter of integrity. This is a matter of judgment. It's not, it's not the issue we had with Nixon. Johnson's issue, in some ways, is worse than Nixon's issue, because he deliberately, built up the Tonkin Bay incident in order to win elections, and he had to have a successful venture in Vietnam. Unable to look at the human side of it, unable even to deal with reality, really, of how impossible victory was, knowing for years, in a sense, at least according to some of the information, and the whole complex hid really from us what was true. So I used to have quite a lot of confidence in people who knew a lot, but after that experience, I really lost my confidence in those who are scientific, technical experts. There are many more things involved. Well, let me just move on to education, because that's something we're all involved in. And I think the primary purpose of our education is for labor. It fits us into the system. It's for work, it's for a job. And you should see the scrambles colleges are going through now in order to prepare people for jobs. Because liberal arts somehow doesn't prepare them for a job. They're going to all kinds of things. And what we think education is socialization. If it's functional, it fits one into the present system. If it's dysfunctional, one becomes a deviant. It does not fit one into the present system. And I think much of my teaching is dysfunctional. Well, my teaching now is dysfunctional. I'm trying to get you unfitted. Now, I don't mean unfitted. I think you'd be better fitted in a way. If you were a little looser about your participation in all kinds of jobs and all kinds of efforts to earn a living, and you could get free enough from the needs that you think are needs in order to not be so worried about maintaining your situations, that I could be the same way. I'm talking about myself. Everything I'm talking about really is addressed to me more than it is to you, because I know me a little bit. And I know all these things I'm saying, I've conditioned me and have affected me and have driven me to work 13 hours a day, 7 days a week in order to achieve success and some sort of success, whatever it be, I don't know. Status, position, not much income, for instance. Education, then, is socialization to fit us into the system. I think that's what we think it is. That's what it ought to be, I think. These myths about what we think it is usually are what we think it ought to be. And if you have all the questions I do about the system, then you have a lot of questions about education. What would education for being look like? As I say, education ought to introduce one into the community of faith and love. And it ought to give one what one needs in order to live in faith and love. Now, the problem is, of course, that our community is very dubiously a community of faith and love. And so in order to think about what might be, there's a sense in which we may have to experiment with new communities. I do think that we do, and that somehow or other, if you think of what the lifestyle program here at Holden is, it's an introduction into the community of faith and love in a community of faith and love. Now, that's why it succeeds. I assume it succeeds. I've talked to a few people whose lives would be just turned around by being here. Now, all kinds of things can turn us around. That's been turned around several times. But education, if we think that we can turn education over to schools and colleges, you know, it's just completely wrong. We've got to do the education. And it's got to be a different education from what it's been. Now, that doesn't mean we'll do it all, but we have to create the context in which education takes place. And as Paul Anderson talking about moving to Seattle and trying to create in the city something like Holden. It will not be like Holden, nothing will be like Holden, but to create a community, I think, in which the analysis I've made here is taken into account, and there's an effort to create a community which deals with things on the basis of this kind of analysis, which would mean all kinds of efforts to cooperate and reduce the demand for necessities, that is, sharing cars and sharing lawnmowers, and I don't know what all you do, but that's part of our creative imagination. Okay, I think the first step in becoming free and whole is to recognize the tyranny of the realm of necessity. And that includes recognizing the way in which technology, science, education are all wrapped up with this realm of necessity. And it's got to be, it's way up here. It's got to be lower down here somehow or other. And we've got to just scratch our brains and hold each other's hands and trying to work our way out of that.
Okay. Once you become radicalized towards this change of values, how do you practicalize it? How do you get people to follow what you feel?
Do you think this is adequate? I don't want to push you a little. How do you look at this kind of analysis? Does it try to bell with you?
Today.
Well, I'm trying to see whether you agree with this more or less. So your question is really a question.
Yeah. I asked for some years.
You agree with
it? I get kind of angry inside, and yet you have to be socially acceptable. You don't want to get so angry that you turn everybody off. Now you got to live with your fellow worker or whoever it is. But take for instance your energy thing. That really. I don't know where to go because all these things that we have, you know, you don't want to point your finger at somebody and say you're a bad boy because you've got that.
No, nobody knows where to go.
But I do agree with that.
So I there's no panacea. There's no you have broadly two kinds of movements. One would be simply recognizing that if you really begin to ask these questions, you cause trouble without doing anything. I was telling the story of the movie Alexander. I don't know whether any of you saw the movie Alexander, but Alexander was married to this very driving wife. She had a two-way talking system to keep track of him out in the field. He was a farmer. And she kept giving him directions. And she died, and he went to bed. He upset the whole town. He went to bed. He just stayed in bed. And he had a dog and went and got groceries from him and so forth. Right? It's a fantastic story, but the point is there. I mean, he went to bed. Can you imagine anybody would go to bed and just stay in bed? He was a very successful farmer and had, terrific. He let all the fowls out. They wandered around the country and he went to bed. Now, I say we ought to go to bed.
But see, what I'm trying to get straight is that when we say we ought to, but then how do you put them?
You live on the edge of the institutions. You can't. There's no point in just withdrawing from them. But you live differently, and if you can get free enough from necessity, and I don't know how you do that. I'm going through that now in terms of, when do you say no to institutions and just drop out? You can't do that unless you cut down all. If you look at these six men from 45 to 70,000, one guy had $2,000 a month expenses that he just couldn't get rid of any way, shape, or form, alimony or something like that. He was really tied into a thing, and I don't know what else he was tied into, but you can't get tied into life the way most middle-class families are, where they're always living in terms of the next raise they're going to get. I mean, you really have to get free, and that's the key, I think, is you get your style of life down and your investments down, and there's no answer to it. I don't have any formula. Some people may have done it already. I know somebody was telling me about a couple of kids who had taken part-time jobs and they were working half-time. Most places you don't get very high salary when you work. Karen Helen was working as a waitress 29 hours a week, so she got pretty good tips and so forth. So she could do her painting. She used to be a teacher, and maybe teaching is more creative and more service to mankind and all that stuff. But now she is free to do her painting. I just think we've got to experiment with all kinds of things. I remember I was talking with a veterinarian last year, and he said, "Well, you know, if I sold my business to my partner, worked 40 hours a week, then I would be free to be something else. Then I wouldn't have the money to bring my five kids home." I mean, very realistic kinds of issues that are involved.
But now, to be happy, we have to bring five kids home.
Well, in theory, he wouldn't have to be, because they would create a community there of meaning that was just wouldn't be like Holden, but it would be equally free and meaningful. I think that's our problem, my problem, Sarah's in Chicago, and that's why we're attracted to the Seattle venture. If you can get a community of meaning in which it's all there, man, you don't worry. I don't worry at least about clothes or anything else when I'm up here, because somehow there's a community of meaning, things going on. It's quite different. It can't be just negative. And many of us have spent so much time working. That's the problem with retirement. People spend their whole lives in their occupation instead of developing. I don't mean instead of, but then they don't have anything to retire to. That's why I say begin to retire today. However old you are, begin to retire today. And think about a pattern of life in which earning a living is subordinate. Again, maybe that earning a living is the most significant and meaningful thing that is to be done for you. I would say probably in a good many cases it would be the exception if it really seemed to be what you were doing without any thought. If it's what you would do if you didn't get any money, then you can say, that's probably the thing for you to do. If you would do it if you didn't get any money. Yes, some other people.
Now, one definition of life for me is service. It's essential for me to live. And that service to myself and service to my fellow man. And the word in conflict with what you have said was my ruling is prayer.
So the question is the content of your service. Now, I think my job is serving students. And I got a real conflict next year. One colleague was fired, he was let go. The other one left. I got to do the work of three guys next year. And he was, I'm going home to service, boy. It's very important work, And all I'll do is talk to students next year about their programs if I do this. So I was thinking of retiring early. Get out of this. Well, it's a very conflict. See, you're serving, and they know I'll serve those students. I won't leave them in the lurch, probably. They know that. So I agree with your service, but the question is the content. How can you find meaningful content? And so much of the work we do in our occupations is not meaningful content. If you say that much of what we do serves needs which are not real, or wants which are not really wants, I mean needs, I get it all mixed up, but you know what I mean. That we are simply creating a great big mass of stuff and services that are not really as necessary as we think they are.
But if your goal is service that does reflect change from the system.
Yep, I worked from 30 to 90 hours a week for 5 years in the freedom movement. 7 years probably, without any pay, simply because I thought it was important. I don't know. I might do that again. If something came along that seemed as important as that. But I did voluntarily. I it cost me money, $2,000 or $3,000 at least a year to do it. And so I believe in that, you know. I believe in finding some things that are important to do and doing them. I think the only way we're going to be able to pick and choose those things is if we can get our realm of necessity in a manageable state. Now, it might just be that everything would coincide. I don't have a formula for figuring out what is service and what is.
I think that coincides in terms of service, in terms of entertainment, in terms of meeting people who laughter, to have fun, to be quiet with themselves and enjoy it. That is service. Service is running around seeing people, I think it's good, but it's like that profound remark of that old guy Luther, a good work is one that does my neighbor good. A lot of what we call service. Including parents who hurt themselves, the phone so I can get my kids up and put inside of the man who they don't want to meet their parents for you.
Everybody buys this? That's a very systemic problem, I'd say, Mary. It's partly personal, but if we had more doctors, I mean, there are just so many people now of a professional nature getting a lot of education and not going to be able to be placed in our system. But they could have spent all that time they spent getting their PhDs and something else, which will not be useful, getting some medical training, and the doctors could work. Doctors and dentists are a few of the people who could work 3 or 4 days a week and earn enough money at the rate that things are going, so they wouldn't have to do the doctoring and the medicine. And if you had enough of them, you know, you take care of it. That's part of it. Part of it's due to the limited number of people available. I don't think most doctors and dentists need, and here I'm really treading on you know, what's need the kind of income that they are capable of getting if they work 6 days a week. I just don't see that. What do you want, Mary?
Well, I just wondered what kind of specific food,
Of course, you see, when we get into the image of the order, I think when I was talking about the us and the we, I think our Christian faith says that we belong to each other and there's just no way out of being part of each other and taking care of each other. Taking care of each other's kids and each other's needs and on a very broad basis. I mean, that's really taking care of ourselves. in one sense, we've got a big enough self, and I think our Christian faith says we do have a big self. We are part of the body, and so we will, but it won't be for money or anything. We just do it. I mean, it's the way people do things up here. I remember one girl said, well, I always babysit up here for nothing. I just figured that was the way people help each other. And then it turned out that other people were getting money. But do you want to say anything more about service?
Well, no, I think, again, though, the training that we have an opportunity, whatever field we feel we can adapt to, provide this kind of service. Whatever we want to
do. Do you want to speak a little more personally, if you don't mind?
Well, I can.
Yeah.
I'm an architect, and the problem that I would imagine most people in the room have found themselves trapped into is a problem of sub-organization. And that we have become a part of this middle-class culture that finds itself out on the rim of the donut with all of our neighborhoods and areas. And we have a fantastic investment within the inner city that is, going to rock. And there is an opportunity here for us as members of the community to restore the homes of our cities. Tremendous investment has already been paid for. We can at least slow down. We'll never stop here, but at least we can begin to rethink and reinvest in the quality of life within the existing structure of our cities. As an example, this is one of my concerns.
Why don't we pick it up here tomorrow? Maybe some of you want to respond to this part of tomorrow a little to think about it. I think we ought to call the official part of this hour over, and there's some other meetings, and we'll have a chance to get back into this. I'm sure we can talk more. I really would like some counter statements if there are any